The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. The Yale Baroque Opera Project is presenting Claudio Monteverdi's opera, The Return of Ulysses, and it is the first production of the opera in New Haven. Ellen Rosand is a Yale professor whose specialties include Italian music and poetry and music of the Baroque and Italian opera. And she is in the studio joined by two of her colleagues, Tony Dorfman, who directed the production, and Grant Herod, who is the musical director. Thanks to all of you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So The Return of Ulysses, it's considered one of Claudio Monteverdi's masterpieces. And I'd like to just begin with what is significant about Claudio Monteverdi's artistry and this opera in particular?
Well, must be me. Well, Monteverdi was the first great opera composer, and everyone else after him owes him a huge debt. He sort of recreated Greek tragedy, especially with this opera. And I don't think he knew anything about what Greek tragedy was, but he believed in human emotions, and he believed in the power of art to transmit them, and he was able to communicate this to his audiences. And this is a very late work of his, 1640. He died in 43, and it was the culmination of a long career as a composer of sacred music and madrigals and dramatic madrigals and operas, and it was one of his last three works, and it's just a phenomenal example of what opera could be and can be.
Mm-hmm. Was he appreciated for this kind of storytelling gift, if you will, in his time, or was this something that sort of the benefit of hindsight has revealed?
Well, he was appreciated in his time. People recognized him as the greatest living musical dramatist. But hindsight is great too. I mean, it's only gotten better since then. I mean, he was not appreciated for 300 years after his death. This opera was only rediscovered in the 1880s. There was no score available until someone uncovered it in Vienna, at the National Library in Vienna in the 1880s.
Did they just run across it, or were they looking for something else? Or?
They just ran across it.
Amazing.
And it was very moving because, of course, there were no Xerox machines in the 1880s. And so the man who discovered it copied it out by hand. And he said why he did it. He said, so this great masterpiece, there would be a second copy in case something happened to the first one.
I didn't know that.
So it truly is, other than the one that he copied out, it is the only
source
copy.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Why is that? Why would something like that happen?
Well, because usually an opera was a work for a single performance and would be not ever used again, and so many operas are not published. And the only it had two performances, and they are both reflected in this one score. I mean, it was expensive to have a score copied, but it was much more expensive to have it published, and no one would have bought it because it was of no use to anyone once it had been performed.
So what were the occasions for which those two productions were staged?
So the first production was for a Venetian opera house in 1640. It's a very interesting story, actually. Monteverdi had written operas for 40 years, since 1607, or 32 years, or whatever it is. In Mantua, he wrote Orfeo, and then he wrote Arianna, both of which were extremely famous and written about, and actually Orfeo was published as a kind of memento for the occasion, because it was the patron was the Duke of Mantua, and it was in honor of him that this was published, and it redounded to his glory to have patronized such a work. But when Ulysses happened, Monteverdi had left Mantua and had been employed in Venice from 1614 on, and opera began to be performed in public theaters in Venice in the late 1630s, but Monteverdi was not involved in it. And people were wondering where he was. Everyone knew he was a great opera composer, but where was he? And the libretto was written for him so that he would come out of retirement, let's say, to show people what real opera was. And that's what he did.
So give me a little brief plot outline of this opera.
Well, this is interesting. It all takes place in just a few hours. Ulysses lands on the beach and finds out that he's home in Ithaca after a storm. And Minerva tells him that his wife is chaste and that a bunch of suitors are in the palace that he needs to vanquish. But she will put him in disguise so he can sneak in. And he does. And he slaughters the suitors. And then about the last fifth of the opera is everybody on stage trying to persuade Penelope that her husband has indeed come back and was the man in disguise as a very old and doddering fellow. She's been alone for so long. It's she in this production who frames the opera. For 20 years, she hasn't seen her husband. Mm-hmm. And she's given up, but, you know, that she'll ever see him again. But still, she hopes. Mm-hmm. And actually, the opera starts with one of the most beautiful. It sounds like an aria, but I'm told by Ellen it's not an aria. It's a recit. Return, return, torna, torna. And her longing for her husband is so palpable and a mixture of hopelessness and hope that you can't listen to it without feeling the same way. It's so gorgeous. And the first time I heard this opera, I'm a Shakespeare director, fairly new to opera. I told Ellen, well, I might be willing to direct it, but we'd have to cut that long aria at the beginning. It was... And the look on her face when I said this was as though, you know, I had just chopped off one foot of hers at the ankle. And now I feel completely the same way. I feel like a complete idiot because that's how we start the opera, with that beautiful, beautiful song.
This is really fascinating, too, because you come from the outside to some degree,
yeah.
You really do bring another perspective, but you're getting up to speed and absorbing this. And so that must be very interesting, and it must be a very different experience than what you are accustomed to working on a production like this.
It is indeed, because the music is already there. And everything I know, really, as a director about working on these operas is attributable to three different sources. One is Grant Herod, the person whose name sounds like the king, who's sitting across from me. He has been the musical director of each. This is the fourth one I've done in, I think, 3 years. And I have the privilege of listening to this music being taught to our students, who are mostly undergraduates, in Italian, and living through that music as an expression of what they're feeling through Grant's artistry and understanding of how the music works. I got into directing these operas by way of a colleague, Richard Lally, who saw a couple productions I did at Yale and thought maybe I should do an opera. And I said, no, I can't possibly do an opera. And
the rest is history. She's done four fabulous shows.
And then Ellen, took a chance on me, and here I am. And I must say that just going to rehearsal, when you're doing a Shakespeare, you know, the music is kind of implicit in the dialogue, but it's not written out in notes. And we know that Shakespeare's actors, at least we're told, had two or three octave ranges and knew how to make all those stresses work toward the end of the lines. But you do have to do almost exactly the same thing. Here we have just this one copy of the score, right? Mm-hmm. And in Shakespeare, often all we have is what's in the first folio. There are not many stage directions. And from the clues in the dialogue, a whole world emerges that it's a great pleasure and privilege to bring to life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the opera works in a similar way in that Monteverdi has interpreted everything in the libretto very clearly in his own musical language that sort of it fills in for a lot of the, again, the missing stage directions and that sort of information that you might find in a modern play or a modern opera. Monteverdi supplies that if you spend enough time parsing the dialogue and interpreting the music to try to be as truthful to the sentiment of the words as possible.
Give an example, Grant. Talk about Avedere, Avedere, Avedere.
Oh.
That business where Eurymaco is arguing with Melanto, who he is having a love affair with, but trying to persuade her at the same time, she's Penelope's ward servant, to he wants her to persuade Penelope to marry him so the two of them can be together. He's one of the suitor kings. And it's a fairly long two-person scene that has its ecstatic moments in which both lovers are consumed by flames licking up their legs. They're so happy to be standing next to each other. And then fear that they will be discovered at any minute. And in the dialogue, toward the end of the scene, he is saying, honey, and I paraphrase, honey, I got to get out of here because I got things to do and we could be discovered at any minute. And we're just standing here in the courtyard and, you know, if we're discovered, it's not going to be good. But he has, and it's not this way in the libretto that was written. People will be able to see us. But in the music that has been written, Avedere happens three times. So in the staging yesterday, we played with, they could come in from that direction, Avedere. They could come in from that direction to see. They could come in from this direction, Avedere. So you get the stage directions as well as his terror and his ambivalence.
Yeah,
he wasn't there yesterday.
Oh, that's right.
That's right. No, and in fact, one of Ellen Rosen's specialties is the study of how the libretto becomes music under the genius of Monteverdi, for example. And it's in grasping Monteverdi's own rhetorical layer that he's put on the libretto in terms of repetition, what words he chooses to repeat, how he sometimes changes the order of words that gives you very precise insights as to, you know, the staging and what the characters are actually thinking at the time.
And they're complicated characters. They are Quicksilver characters. What they are thinking and what they want shifts in response to what they see and hear and feel from the person beside them. And that's very Shakespearean.
And it just makes for a fascinating semester. It's such a privilege to actually teach the students their music, because you just gain so much insight into the Monteverdi's process just by this sort of focused study on it, that maybe in a professional production somewhere where you're under stricter time frames that you don't really get to go into the depth of it maybe mm-hmm. quite as much.
It's a great luxury. We co-teach this class performing early opera. And the first half of the semester is spent, not only everybody read the Odyssey, compare your character in the Odyssey with your character in the opera, but they also got music coaching. And it wasn't until after our spring break that we started the stage directing. But by that point, I was really ready to go because I thought I understood what the story was and who these people were.
What about the pit, if you will? Who is playing in the who are the instrumentalists?
Well, one of the reasons we do early music in general is to we try to do it authentically in that we use the same forces that Monteverdi used, not for authenticity's sake, but just to recreate the conditions and the situation under which he presented this music, thinking that that was probably would be true to his intentions, and to sort of evoke whatever artistry is in the music by using the same means he did. So we're using the pit setup that he would have been accustomed to, as far as we can tell from the surviving records. We're using two harpsichords, two long-necked lutes called theorbos, and then a small violin band, two violins, two violas, and a cello. And we'll also use one other bowed instrument, a viola da gamba. And that'll be it. These were commercial ventures in 17th century Venice, and the impresarios wanted to make money. And so
the smaller the orchestra, the better.
Right.
Also, the theaters were very small. The theaters were small, and in order to hear the singers, you couldn't have a big orchestra.
Right. This was an age when the singers who sang really loudly got work in the churches, because those were the big cavernous spaces, and the more refined artistic voices were thought to be more suitable for the stage, because the theaters were much more intimate.
Well, the other thing is that the words are much more important in an opera like this than in any other kind of opera. The music comes so directly from them that you absolutely must understand them. And you can't have an orchestra covering.
So. Right. In fact, 30 years later, in the same Venetian theaters, opera evolves into the opera seria type, where you have a distinction between bits of recitative, where they sort of talk in music, and then the aria, where they express their emotional feelings. At this time, there's still, especially in Monteverdi, there's not quite this clear-cut separation of recitative and aria. And so Monteverdi, he uses so many different techniques of there'll be a little bit of arioso, and then we'll go into a triple time section that, that sort of bumps up the energy. And then maybe a couple of lines of recitative set to distinct rhythms in the music. And then maybe a bar of completely free recitative where there's only one sort of note with a fermata on it and a bunch of words you're supposed to speak to that to that note. He uses so many techniques to...
I like those barbershop trios of the suitors.
They're cute, too.
And then they launch into these absolutely contemporary-sounding numbers.
Harmonies, yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you get around? You're talking about what came down to, balancing the forces for an old... theater kind of a setup. How are you going to manage that? Will you have amplification? And if you do, how do you balance that without making it sound weird?
Oh, gosh,
no. We don't have amplification.
Yes, we're very proud not to have amplification.
Our theater has what? How many seats?
About 400.
400 seats.
Packed, yeah. It's small. It's a university theater. It's a proscenium stage. It has, we make room for a pit by removing the first two rows. And the singers, the students, we're never quite sure which opera we're going to do until after the auditions. And the auditions happened, I think, for this opera early September. People were cast, and then they registered for this semester. But when we heard those voices, we were able to say, yeah, I think we're going to be able to do Ulysse. They're glorious. And they sound glorious, and their voices peel out into that smallish proscenium theater.
And some of them are 18 and 19 years old.
Unbelievable.
So, you're producing a work for the very first time. The musicians don't have any preconceived notions about this work. The audience has no frame of reference for it. The first thing that comes to my mind is there must be some special challenges, but maybe even some advantages to producing an opera that's unfamiliar to most people. So what might those challenges and advantages be?
Well, it seems like the challenge is to get an audience to abandon their preconceptions of what an opera is and not expect big arias and a big orchestra. But we, our audience is sort of used to it because this is our eighth production. And each time there are more people because word has gotten around that, you know, if you really want to know what opera is about, come to these productions. And so that's an advantage to not having preconceived notions. Now, disadvantage?
I don't know. I don't feel that there's any disadvantage. In fact, I get kind of restless seeing ordinary operas.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about maybe the musicians, though. Is there extra training? Is there extra maybe unlearning of other expectations from doing other works that you have to do to try to prepare them for something that's, you know, they can't go listen to the recording or they can't
performance. The students can't. That's a big advantage. That's not a disadvantage because they have to use their own. And then they take lessons from Grant. And as far as the orchestral musicians are concerned, they know how to do this. They are not people who necessarily play in other opera orchestras.
Right. We're extremely fortunate to have on the Yale faculty Robert Mealy, one of the leading Baroque violin specialists in the country, if not the world. And he has an ensemble of grad students there that become our small string orchestra, and they really sound great, and they get the style from Robert, and it's really one of the highlights of our productions. Is the not that there's that much orchestral music, in fact in our 2-hour production there will be about 20 minutes worth of that, you know, that the violins actually play. But when they play, it sounds fabulous. It sounds really great.
Mm-hmm. So we already talked about people who expect the big, you know, the big voices in the big opera production are have to sort of change their attitude about that. What about what it looks like? What about the costumes and the sets and so forth?
We were just talking about that. You know, we have the benefit of a first-rate, shall I say, drama school at Yale with real know-how and really good people in every aspect of theatrical production. So each of our shows, you can see excerpts of them on our website, each of our shows looks different and phenomenal. I mean, the costumes are, well, this year, they're...
The costumes this year are designed by the head of the costume department at the Long Wharf Theater, because her name is Valerie Webster, and she's very talented, and I've worked with her a lot before I started doing these operas. The sets, the scenic design this year is by a graduate of the Yale Drama School, Catherine Day, and we also have a professional lighting designer, and I don't think we have a sound designer this time.
No.
We have a professional prop person who works at Yale Drama School and Yale Rep. So we're right in the middle of this concentration of specialists in design. We're setting this opera because so much of the lyrical stuff in the libretto reminded me of Petrarch's poems in the 14th century. And, of course, it takes place more or less in 12th century B.C. archaic Greece, but it's all through the lens of 17th century Venetian Baroque aesthetic. So let's just say that, like Shakespeare, it's delightfully anachronistic.
But it's not modern dress either.
No, it isn't.
We haven't done a single one in modern dress.
Really? From the?
I don't think
no.
so.
No, and we're very fortunate to have, we have a budget from a Mellon Foundation grant that Ellen was awarded a few years ago. And so our production values are extremely high because we have such a pool of talent to work with at Yale. But also just the creative team is just, you know, really fine and have very high standards. And so with the resources we have, the shows look and sound just really beautiful.
They sure do. I think we're spoiled. We're happy.
Well, and the money is running out, too. So we're scrounging around to figure out how to keep this thing afloat because it's a unique project in the United States.
I don't think there's any other undergraduate college in America that has a baroque opera season with courses and conferences and productions and symposia.
I don't think so.
Will you take this on the road, do you think?
We've wanted to take several of our productions on the road. So far, we haven't had any. Did we have one inquiry?
One went up to...
We went up to Norfolk.
Norfolk, yes. Yeah. Oh, that was great. That was Orfeo about 4 or 5 years ago.
Haven't there been just a couple nibbles from Glimmerglass?
There were nibbles, but it's hard to take these on the road because the students graduate, you know,
right.
Or they go away for the summer, or, you know, so it's pretty hard to mount it with a new cast. I mean, we could do it. It would work, but we haven't gotten to that point.
But they are all videoed.
And... Yeah, we have beautiful videos that we spent a fair amount of money getting good videos so that, you know, they are available and they're remarkable, actually.
Well, it's a very impressive and obviously very thrilling project, and I congratulate all of you for this wonderful collaboration, and thanks for making time to chat about it.
Well, it's very
exciting
to us.
We're thrilled to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Suzanne.